Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. In July of this year, the Simon Fraser Student Society initiated layoffs for 8 of 20 student service and operations staff positions, a significant decision that, according to the organization, was made due to budgetary restraints and the society's current deficit. These positions were represented by a local nonprofit union organization, QP3338, who have come out publicly to state that these notices of layoff are in direct violation of the union's collective agreement with the student society. CJSF reached out to QP for more information on these alleged violations. We then were able to speak with the union's president, Shaneza Bacchus, who provided a timeline of events regarding the layoff notices, the union's response, and the specific alleged violations of the union's collective agreement.
July 17th, starting at 3:18 p.m., we received by email 5 of the 8 notices of layoffs via email that were sent to the members. So it's a really poor way to deliver these news, and the key piece here is we were not given notice that these layoffs were being sent to the members. I can't stress how it's contrary to acting in good faith. It's very disrespectful. It's unprofessional. And the fact is, they have a legal obligation to notify the union when they're laying off individuals, because then we have to schedule meetings with the individuals. So they did that. The emails went out. I saw these come in, and knowing full well that the entire membership is going to know that this is happening within minutes, I sent an update to the membership saying that the union has received these notices without prior notice that they were going out, and we will be addressing it with the employer. Shortly after that, the employer started holding meetings with those who were on site about the layoffs, again, without notice to the union, and without affording these impacted members their right to union representation. So when I received that information, I immediately went down to the SFSS with the intention of stopping those meetings, because that was contrary to the collective agreement. It's contrary to basic employment code. So when I did that, I absolutely did that firmly. I did it loudly. I have no apologies for how I choose to protect members. Well, I shouldn't say choose to. It was necessary to shut it down. I confronted two leads in the department, the HR lead and operations lead. Both denied that these were layoff meetings, but what else would you call them? I then confronted the SFSS president about it, and he claimed that the members did not need union representation. And I did raise my voice, and I said that is not his decision to make. This is their right, and we should have been notified. So that was that. That's what happened. And of course, I don't like engaging on that level, but we have to firmly and loudly protect the collective agreement and members' rights. And when they're being violated to such a high degree, we have no choice but to act in that manner.
Bacchus then went on to highlight one of the specific sections of the collective agreement that the union is claiming was violated by the Simon Fraser Student Society, as well as how these layoff proceedings should have occurred.
So we left, we spoke with the impacted members briefly, and then we left, and then we're here picking up the pieces after that. In terms of Section 54 and how it should go and how it should have gone and what we're trying to correct at this time is, so the notice is served to the union, and then the union and the employer would then meet over a series of meetings, the labor adjustment meetings, to decide how this is going to go. We would talk about everything from voluntary severance, if they want to put out a call for those that want to leave employment and offer enhanced severance above the collective agreement, ensure seniority is protected, other aligning articles are protected, and then we arrange a schedule to have these meetings in person to ensure that the member is there with the appropriate HR forms and information that they prepare and that their union rep is there with them after, because after this news is delivered, it is very hard for the impacted person.
Later in our conversation, Bacchus also wanted to stress that while she understands the budgetary restraints that led to these layoffs for the union, this is a matter of legality and labor rights.
I just want to say that I do understand the budget. The reasons given were budget. I do understand the concerns that they have expressed. We know that in this climate, that is a management right to restructure and to lay off. We know we can't stop it. The goal is to ensure that it proceeds fairly according to all relevant legislation.
Lastly, Bacchus had this to say to SFU students who may be concerned about the impacts that these layoffs will have on student support services.
I really would. I would encourage a student body to press the council for explanation on this. I think this impacts them significantly from the fall. This is not next year. This is in a matter of weeks. They will see serious impacts to their educational and student experience. And I think they deserve answers. I think there's accountability here and transparency that's lacking. Yeah. And I would ask for everyone to please be kind to the QP staff, and because they're experiencing, there are things being said online which we cannot control, but online bullying and harassment has a real effect on people, and the staff are significantly dedicated to the work that they do. Members routinely give of their own pocket to support student-funded programs. Like the food bank, like they do really good things from the goodness of their heart because they're dedicated to their work and their work ethic. So I would really ask for kindness both in person and online to all staff right now. They're going through a really difficult time.
Once again, that was our conversation with Shaneza Bacchus, the union president for QP3338, on the recent notices of layoffs for 8 out of 20 staff positions in the Simon Fraser Student Society. After this interview, CJSF reached out to the Simon Fraser Student Society for a response to the alleged violations of their collective agreement due to the ways in which these layoffs were enacted. At the time of this recording, we have received no response from the organization. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Bird Note. Every spring, in the grasslands that remain in the Great Basin and Great Plains, you may be treated to the flight display of the long-billed curlew, accompanied by its bubbling song. The male flies up with rapidly beating wings and glides down, then up again and down, stitching a series of arcs across the sky and calling as he goes. Long-billed curlews are the largest of North American shorebirds. They winter on mudflats along the coasts of Mexico and the southern U.S., where they extract small crabs from their burrows for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Like most shorebirds, they roost and forage in flocks, often with other species. When they are disturbed, their loud flight calls sound the alarm that a potential predator is near. But when the birds arrive on their breeding grounds on the prairies, their hormones put them in a different mood. It's time to leave the flock, to display, sing, mate, and nest. And their whistles can be heard again, dropping from the sky. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you in loving memory of former Bird Note board member Tom Darden, with thanks to his family for their support.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. From Mexico to Mongolia, Sweden to South Africa.
Many, many, many people across the globe are feeling the effects of extreme heat that is fueled by climate change.
Roop Singh is at the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center, which co-authored a report about global extreme heat from May 2024 to May 2025.
We found that 4 billion people, about 49% of the global population, experience at least 30 additional days of extreme heat due to human-caused climate change.
And in many areas of the tropics, people saw more than 100 additional days of extreme heat. That is, days that are hotter than 90% of the temperatures historically observed in the local area. Extreme heat can be deadly, but Singh says cities and countries can help protect residents, for example, by educating people on how to stay hydrated, increasing access to air conditioning, and developing early warning systems for heat waves.
This threat is here and now. It's not really a future problem. It will continue to get worse. But there are tons of actions that we can take to reduce the impacts.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Noise of Carpet explores 1990s indie classics, recently exhumed underground gems, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Tune in if you're a slacker, loser, or creep for an hour of positively nostalgic triggers and some new stuff too on CJSF 90.1 FM or streaming at cjsf.ca.
Six Nations' ongoing litigation case with the governments of Canada and Ontario surrounding lands allegedly lost along the Grand River, also known as the Haldimand Track, has been granted a trial start date of October 5th, 2026. The Haldimand Track encompasses 6 miles on either side of the Grand River from its source located in Dundalk, Ontario, where it then flows to its mouth in Lake Erie. Six Nations claims those lands were originally a part of the Haldimand Proclamation of 1784, in which Frederick Haldimand, the governor of the province of Quebec at the time, granted that tract of land to be given to the peoples of Six Nations for their use and benefit to enjoy forever. The Six Nations community has long called for some kind of justice and launched its litigation against both the federal and provincial governments in 1995. The case surrounds about 950,000 acres of lands along the Grand River in Ontario that Six Nations claims were lost between the late 1700s to mid-1800s. It alleges that Canada failed to set aside those lands, improperly sold, and mismanaged the proceeds of sales from them. In a July 29th media release, Six Nations of the Grand Rivers litigation team announced that a trial judge will be appointed to the case in January 2026, and the trial start date will follow on October 5th, 2026. During an interview with CJKS earlier this year in March, Six Nations Director of Lands and Resources Lonnie Bomberry spoke on the scale of the case and it possibly being a reason for what he believes was hesitancy on Canada and Ontario's part in calling for a start of the trial.
And I think why the Canada and Ontario is being so obstructive and obstinate in trying to resolve this by, you know, just sitting down and talking about it is because it's just too big for them. It's a mind-boggling case in terms of the wrongs are committed, the damages that can be attributed to those wrongs, and the amount of money that's involved in those, in righting those wrongs. So it is something that at this point they're just not wanting to address and put their minds to, so they're just engaged in delaying the start of the trial and also in the putting obstacles in a way to say that this trial's got to be a full-fledged trial. It's going to take almost a year to be heard on just on our first issue. And so they're taking the high road on that, that it's going to be a full trial with all the evidence being put by both us and by them. And a lot of arguments in the way trials go during the course of it. So they're saying it's going to be a long trial. At this point, you know, it doesn't look like there's, at this point, a chance to sit down and saying it doesn't need to be let's try to resolve this.
In the 2025 March interview with CJKS, Bomberry also detailed the possibility of reaching a settlement for both parties before or during the trial, if that's something that could be negotiated.
A lot of time these things happen just before the trial is about to start, and then the parties get together, and a lot has to do with the trial judge saying to sitting down with, you know, with Canada, Ontario, and Six Nations and saying, look, you guys, and it's their obligation to try to get the parties to negotiate a settlement rather than running a long, expensive trial and saying, look, you know, it's in the interest of the Crowns, Canada, Ontario, to resolve this. It might not look good for you in the end. Let's talk about, and if Six Nations is willing to talk, the plaintiff's willing to talk, let's sit down and do that, and let's see whether we can resolve this without having to go to trial. Or a lot of times the trial does start and things aren't going for so well for either party, and negotiations can start at that point. So it could happen either immediately or before the trial, or actually when the trial starts, that there could be a push to resolve it, either at the party's own initiative or at the initiative of the trial judge.
CJKS did confirm with Crown Indigenous Relations and Northern Affairs Canada that the expected trial start date is October 5th, 2026, and CJKS will be following this story as it approaches the trial start date and will provide more updates as information becomes available. I'm Andrew Dow, and this news story is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, which supports the creation of original civic journalism.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. A team of researchers at Simon Fraser University, led by Professor of Plant Functional Genomics, Jim Mattson, has successfully grown both blueberry and raspberry crops in the university's biotech greenhouse during the winter. This marks a major development in the team's research project, which has been working to identify the environmental conditions best for indoor blueberry and raspberry production. This project also aims to adapt the berries to the new environment through gene editing. CJSF recently took a trip down to the research team's lab, where Jim Mattson gave us a tour of not only the lab facilities, but the biotech greenhouse as well.
Yeah, and this western red cedar was a very nice tree until a few years ago, and it died from repeated drought stress in the summer. And that's happening all over the campus. Western red cedar is quite drought sensitive. So that's climate change. And it's actually well on the way for agriculture too, that you need to adjust varieties based on climate change.
This is the greenhouse. Always quite messy. And also quite hot. Let's see how hot it is.
I guess for the next year, do you foresee this just improving and getting better?
Yes, but we're not doing it here. We're doing it primarily in Chilliwack, and where we have a larger greenhouse. It's highly controlled. We measure all the inputs. We measure the amount of electricity, the amount of natural gas used for heating, and so on, to find out a good compromise, I should say, between growth and cost of producing. In the end, it's not just science. You have to make it commercially feasible too. Otherwise, it's not going to be used by anyone, so to say.
Another question we had for Mattson was, what was contributing to this project's success? Why were they seeing progress in indoor berry growing that hadn't been seen before?
I think the gene editing is a big part, because it's really hard to change in a short time traits in perennial species in particular. They take years to. It usually takes something like 10 to 20 years to make a new variety, and the changes are usually incremental. And blueberry in particular is really hard, because it has four copies of each gene. And for some traits, you need to knock out not just one copy, but all four. And that can never be done, or very It's very difficult to do that by traditional breeding, especially since no one knows what gene to look at that happens. So we can do it in a controlled way without changing anything else in the genome, just changing that gene. So that's a big change. There's a revolution, I think, in agriculture, the gene editing. They will not... So transgenics are highly controversial, even though it has been shown that it is safe and it's too expensive. So it's only the big companies that can pursue them right now. It costs many millions, actually tens of millions, to get new varieties approved that are transgenic. So this is sort of the opportunity for breeders of all breeds and species to do something. So it's quite a change. It's not just the big crops like maize and rice and wheat. It's other crops that can be bred in a fairly short time for particular traits without changing the whole genome, so to say, mixing up the whole genome. So that's a big change.
He then went on to explain the mechanisms behind the berry growing process.
So we did a test this winter with both... raspberry and blueberry, primarily blueberry, but raspberry as well, and it worked out surprisingly well. So blueberry, normally they make the flower buds in the late summer when days are getting shorter and the nights are getting cooler. Then the plant get the signal that it's time to make flower buds, but then they go dormant from the same treatments. When it gets cooler and shorter day, after a while they go dormant, and then they stay dormant until the spring, until about March, April, when the longer days and warmer temperatures make them wake up and start growing again. So the problem is, if you then want to grow them in the winter time, you want to induce flower bud formation, but you do not want them to go dormant. Because if they go dormant, they're going to stay. It doesn't matter if you put light on them and high temperature. They're not going to do anything for a few months. So they need a specific time of cold treatment before they start growing again. But if you time it correctly, you can induce flower buds, but they do not go dormant. And that's what we did with the blueberry in the fall. So we took them inside before they went dormant, and then they started growing in... the first one already in September, and we had the first crop in December, with the peak of the crop in January and February.
During our conversation, Mattson also stressed the potential that this project has to progress Canada's domestic agriculture.
Well, we got a grant from the Weston Family Foundation, which is tied, of course, to the Loblaws and so on. They are the owners. Weston is the owners of Loblaws and so on. And what happened a few years ago during COVID, there was problems with import because of the COVID crisis. And this company and other companies and consumers realized that, hey, there can be big disruptions in import of produce, including berries, not just berries, but other too, during events of COVID. And of course now with Trump and his activities, then it's entirely possible that these things will be more expensive too. So it's good to have a domestic production.
Well, there is still much more work that needs to be done to make these berries viable for commercial production. Jim Mattson and his research team are optimistic of the project's future outcomes. Once again, this has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You are listening to CJLO News. Real champagne comes from Champagne, France, Parmesan cheese from Emilia-Romagna in Italy, and the Montreal melon comes from the borough of Notre-Dame-de-Grâce in Montreal. The Montreal melon was once a luxury good grown right in NDG and shipped to places like New York and Philadelphia. It was a popular and famous fruit from the 1880s into the mid-1930s, until it went practically extinct. Now, in 2025, a gardening group based out of the Loyola campus is trying to revive and recultivate the Montreal melon and restore it, at least locally, to its former glory. But growing this melon has been a story of trials and tribulations, beetles, bad luck, and theft.
The Montreal melon has been like great mythos among Montreal gardeners.
That was Nico Quinn, the co-founder of Cult of Action, a community gardening and food security group that has been protecting and gardening a plot of land at Loyola campus since 2022. Quinn is the manager of the Loyola plot. Hear them explain a bit of the history of the Montreal melon.
The melon was being sold to very wealthy areas in New York City, Boston, Philadelphia. Most notably, it was served at the Delmonico Hotel, which today is still known for its like kitchen fare. It's a very, very expensive hotel. And it would be sold cartside, so like very, very wealthy people would go to the Delmonico and order the elusive Montreal melon, and it would be brought up by a worker who would slice one melon. It would be $2 or $3, which today would be anywhere from $70 to $100.
The Montreal melon, also known as the nutmeg melon for its distinct nutmeg flavor, was difficult to grow and ship. By the mid-1900s, it began falling out of fashion, and by the 1960s, it was thought to be extinct.
It's a very expensive melon. It's labor intensive to grow and to ship. So it did not serve the international factory food system needs of, you know, being ready to be shipped. It like doesn't continue to ripen once it's refrigerated. So this is why it starts to demand. And now we have the rise of, you know, its descendant, like later on coming the honeydew, the cantaloupe. They're a derivative of this Montreal melon.
But seeds have been discovered in different places since the 1990s for the Montreal melon. Last year, an anonymous source left 200 of the seeds on a desk in Dawson College, belonging to a friend of the garden. The Cult of Action Garden gave away many of these seeds to other local community groups and sold several to hobby gardeners around NDG. But here at the Loyola plot, they focused resources and energy on regrowing the Montreal melon. This notoriously finicky, nearly extinct fruit still proved difficult to grow. Beetles ate many of the melons, others were destroyed by groundhogs. One prized melon remained growing at the Cult of Action Garden, but just as it had almost ripened the morning of this report, the perfect Montreal melon was stolen.
So yeah, it is, and you know, any volunteer who has come, anyone who will listen, I have told, you know, the history and how special it is, and now that they are a part of history. Like anyone who weeds that melon, looks at that melon, I'd be sure to let them know, like, you know, you're one of 100 people who have seen this melon in the modern age. Like it's very special for us all to be invested in it. And now it has been taken. So It's very, we're all devastated. Like, it's been a tough morning because we discovered it today. So it's been like 2 hours of screaming and crying and pounding our fists into the ground because it's been taken. Like, what the heck? And I guess in a way, I hope that they knew what it was, because if they didn't know and they picked an unripe Montreal melon and then not e- like be like, this doesn't even taste good. Like, but they didn't just take a melon. Like, it is a piece of agricultural history, and that a lot of our community members are emotionally bound up in, so it's a huge loss.
Despite this theft, the attempts to regrow the Montreal melon continue around the borough, with this plot at the Loyola campus leading the initiative.
So, for example, some Italians will say it's not limoncello if the lemons aren't from the Amalfi Coast or Sorrento or areas like this. Those are regions. Here in the Montreal melon, this is the NDG melon. Because of the microclimate that happens, you know, of course we're on an island, the microclimate that happens in between Mount Royal and the St. Lawrence, and we're on a sloped hill, we're in the valley of this area. So it's a very, very specific microclimate. So a Montreal melon that's grown in Rosemont is not going to be the same as a Montreal melon that's grown in NDG. It is the most hyperlocal food, vegetable, anything. Like even Matsutake mushroom is very famous for, you know, Japan. It's also in BC, but like the Montreal melon, even the difference in borough will change the flavor of the melon.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
How many hits will it take for you to get with me? 'Cause deep in my soul, I've always known that I'm a Whitney.
die to save my life. Stretched upside down in my limousine, I'm the Antichrist.